Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bounds. On today's show, we're looking ahead at the best of autumn's cultural offerings. We're discussing TV, books and art, so no matter whether you're in the mood for watching, reading or looking, we have got you covered. Among many other things on the agenda, we've got the return of a much-loved American sitcom, a bold retelling of George Orwell's 1984, and an exhibition that explores notions of beauty across time and cultures. There's plenty to talk about, so let's get stuck straight into it. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by the TV critic and broadcaster Scott Bryan, the arts and culture writer Holly Black, and the writer and literary critic Chris Power. Welcome all to the programme. Let's have a cacophony of hellos at the beginning.
Hello. Hello.
All at the same time. That's how to control the show. Exactly. It's lovely to have you all around the table. We've got the brains trust in today. It's wonderful stuff. I said it before we switched on the microphones, I'll say it again, returning champions wafting their silverware in the face of Holly Black. Welcome to the programme. Lovely to have a first-time critic on in the shape of Holly Black. Lovely to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've got such short time. We've got 29 minutes to cover all of those bases in the introduction and some more besides. So, Scott, we're going to start with you and the return of a much-loved sitcom. Where are we going?
Well, it is Frasier. I mean, to save time, I hardly need to talk about this show really and what it is, because it is one of the most well-known and most well-long-running characters and TV shows. And, of course, a lot of expectation into this Paramount Plus revival that is happening later in the year. But I guess a lot of questions around why. Because, of course, when you bring back...
That wasn't on my script, but it could well have been.
It could well have been. Because this is the thing. Like, I think this was announced in 2021. That was at the peak of streaming when, of course, all of the different streaming networks were firing at all cylinders. Things were being reprised all the time. Sex and the City, for example, being another example with And Just Like That. So, of course, when you're launching a streaming service, Paramount Plus, what better to do than have the biggest IP and the most well-known show, particularly that the people behind it, Kelsey Grammer, really wanted this to be reprised in the first place. But what I think is really intriguing about this is about whether there is really the demand for it, because a lot of the names that were so much a core part of the original and well-known sitcom about a guy who was essentially giving advice in a radio studio are no longer attached to this new series. David Hyde Pierce, who plays Niles Crane, Jane Leaves, who played Daphne Moon, and Perry Gillian, who plays Roz Doyle, are not attached to this reprisal. Neither is, of course, John Mahoney, who sadly passed away in 2018. But what you have instead is probably one of the most surreal castings I've seen for a while. Nicholas Lyndhurst.
I know!
From Only Fools and Horses.
I saw this on social media and thought it was... Thought it was a fake picture.
I mean, what a weird thing to make up, I would say.
I know, but
he is
bizarre.
In this as a sort of old college buddy who is now a university professor. And I always love this in a TV show when they have a character reintroduced of, oh, you know, we've been great friends for many decades. We've just never talked about each other in the main show or ever alluded to them whatsoever. But now they are a central figure in my life.
Yeah.
He stars in this too. But they've really been under wraps about what it will be following. The synopsis of the series is the most vaguest I've ever seen of anything. It says Frasier is off to a different city with new challenges to face, new relationships to forge, and an old dream or two to finally fulfil. That's pretty much every TV show that's ever existed.
I'm getting a bit of...
Slight bit of cynicism.
I'm getting commissioners.
You're getting a little bit of slight bit of cynicism. I mean, it could work. It could work,
yeah.
Of course. I mean, I think this is the fact. Many, many people are going to be tuning in why by just sheer intrigue.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way you get people through the door these days. I just think that now that streaming is, of course, going through a massive period of consolidation, a lot of streaming giants are now cutting their shows, not making new ones. I wonder whether such a show like this would have been made today. I mean, this is the thing. It takes a long while for a show from the original idea to when it's on TV to actually come to fruition.
I'm getting a lot of kind of, if I'm the commissioner, the original broadcaster, I wouldn't be expecting from Frasier a "for some reason" in the script. It seems like there's a lot of "for some reason" here. Well, if you are intrigued, in Frasier, they didn't need to rename it, at least, because it seems mostly about one man and nothing else.
Yes.
That is premiering on Paramount Plus on October the 13th. Thank you very much, Scott. Holly, we're going to start with you, and we're going to start with a show called Inside Other Spaces, Environments by Women Artists, and this is at Munich's Haus der Kunst. So just let's tackle the title, perhaps. These are installation works. These are the kinds of... What are environments in an artistic sense?
Yeah, well, that's quite an interesting question in of itself. And these are actually reconstructions of environments that were made from the mid-50s to the mid-70s. And they're really, you know, we're at the vanguard of what we would call immersive environments, which is a term that everyone uses a lot these days. Whether it be...
I like to make this the studios, surely.
That's the thing, isn't it? You're like, what makes something immersive? Is this immersive right now?
Pretty immersive.
You know, exactly. We've got audio, we're in a space. But so really, it's the reconstruction of 12 key works that were made by artists who were, for the most part, tackling what was, in a broad term, called feminist art at the time, you know, at the beginning of the feminist art program in LA. So you have artists such as Judy Chicago and Faith Wilding, who were creating spaces. So, yeah, things that you can usually get into, I think, is quite a key part, the physical get into.
Yeah.
So there's a piece called Feather Room, which is literally a sort of almost blow-up inflatable space that was filled with talcum powder and chicken feathers that Judy Chicago created for two other artists. And another piece called Crochet Environment, where you can actually climb into these spaces that are almost like a cocoon. And that piece was actually featured in Woman House, which was a very important exhibition slash basically Judy Chicago, Miriam Shapiro and a few other artists took over a mansion in Hollywood and turned it into like a crazy feminist art space in the best sense possible. So, yeah, it's really about these works that were also very ephemeral. So people, you know, once they were seen, they were often dismantled. They were often using quite lo-fi materials, might not have been that well documented. So the Haus der Kunst have worked with the artists themselves, archivists, gallerists, you know, newspaper articles to rebuild these environments and give us a chance to get back in them.
Nice. And that is on from the 8th of September 2023 until the 10th of March 2024. I'll point out that I'll give all the listings at the end of the programme anyway, so we don't have to take notes as we go. Chris, lovely to have you back on the programme. And you're worrying that side of the desk with having brought this particular tome in, and I do use that word advisedly. Where are we going next?
I think I'm tilting it down.
We're
going to Norway and Russia next. This is Carlo over Knausgaard's The Walls of Eternity, full marks for a very metal title, which is the sequel to his novel The Morning Star, which came out a couple of years ago and was his first kind of big novel since My Struggle, this 3,000-page, six-volume auto-fictional kind of epic that made him a global literary superstar. And The Morning Star was a sort of, there were nine POV characters and this new planet had appeared in the sky and it was incredibly hot and the dead seemed to be coming back to life. And it kind of leaves a lot of stories kind of on a cliffhanger. So you might reasonably expect, having read that 600-page novel, that this 800-page sequel would kind of carry on where it left off. But oh no.
The only thing it's got in common is the leather bracelets, right? Leather wristbands.
That's right. Instead, he takes us back to 1986, to this guy called Sivert, who's just come out of his national service in Norway. And he's just kind of, you know, getting back into life in his small town. He's trying to chat up girls. He's trying to get on with his younger brother. He's masturbating quite a lot. He's just trying to find his way. His mum's falling ill. And we actually spend like 400 pages with him. I mean, Holly was talking about, you know, immersive environments. That's really what this novel is and what Knausgaard kind of specialises in. He kind of takes you into the rhythm of his characters' lives. So you're with them for, you know, the breakfast they make or the football practice he goes to or the walk he takes into town, you know, and these rhythms that really kind of, well, really work for me. I know they don't necessarily work for everyone, but there is this sort of inner tension driving this book in that Sivert finds these letters from his dad who died when he was young. He died when he was when Civet was 11. That suggest that Civet's got a half sister in Russia, and then she's the kind of next POV character that we kind of explore in the latter half of the book.
Yeah, it's amazing. And this is obviously a huge play from the publishers. It's published by Penguin Press, we should say.
It's this Harville, is Harville Secker, Harville part Secker, of Penguin Random
part,
House.
Part of yeah. Penguin, yeah. This will obviously be the size of it. They will think that this is, for a lot of people, their sort of autumn to winter warmer, right? This is their long nights round the fire will be warmed by Nausgaard's
sure, yeah.
immersion.
I mean, what fuel crisis? You can probably just like tear off each page as you read it, and you know that would last you until spring, perhaps.
I know. We'll move on now, Chris. Thank you very much for talking us through that one, and we'll put the table back together after you've put that one down on the floor. We were talking about The Walls of Eternity by Carl Ove Knausgård. Scott, we're back to you.
Yeah,
we're keeping it vaguely scientific with some lessons in chemistry. What on earth are we doing here?
Yeah, so this is based on the acclaimed novel by Bonnie Garmus. It's a Apple TV Plus series that's also out on the same day as Fraser, October 13th. And it's based on the incredibly successful novel. I mean, it has sold many copies, been sold to 40 different countries. This is sort of the main focus is a character called Elizabeth Zott, who is a research chemist in 1960s America, who then becomes a star of a cooking show called Supper at Six, and then uses that role to quietly introduce and use a platform to speak to the millions of housewives watching at home. It taps into, I think, male-dominated industries, misogyny, sexism, pioneering women within these fields. I think there's been a lot of comparisons to in the novel sense, although I haven't read the book because I can't read because I'm dyslexic. A lot of comparisons to The Queen's Gambit and The Marvellous Mrs. Maisel. Mm. I also just think it's quite exciting because Apple TV Plus, which is the provider of this series, have just been on such a streak, a winning streak at the moment. I think they've really been able to establish themselves as a place for intellectual, rather suspenseful dramas. When a lot of rivals from Netflix to Amazon have proliferated into a lot of reality shows and unscripted formats and at times quite down market shows, I think Apple have purposefully tried to rein it in and try to be seen distinctive in the same way as, let's say, HBO are. So I think this show fits well in line with the types of shows that you would be expecting to have on Apple.
It does feel like that, doesn't it? It feels like there's quality control. I don't feel like there's less but good stuff, I feel, with Apple. I like also the idea of dinner, Supper at Six.
Yes.
Very Dutch concept, isn't it? Seems to me.
I think nobody has the time anymore to have supper at 6.
We have dinner at 6, it's fine.
It's more of a panic at 8:30. Yeah. I think that's more of the sense. But no, you're certainly right in terms of Apple sort of seeming distinctive. I was at the Edinburgh TV Festival the other week, which is the place where a lot of TV executives, a lot of the streamers go. Mm. And what I found to be so interesting this year is that a lot of announcements are made about a lot of programmes coming from a lot of different networks. I think it's harder and harder to tell what shows are actually coming from where, because they can really come from anywhere. I think the age in which networks used to be very distinctive about the types of shows they would and wouldn't do, from Netflix right to Amazon, I mean, even on commercial channels too, is becoming increasingly blurry. And I actually think that's a step backwards, because you want to have a very clear brand of this is the types of shows when I log into your service. Yeah. If you log into them expecting any range of shows, then I don't think you're going to necessarily kind of be overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that's on there if it is the same as everywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, people of a certain age would say, I wasn't allowed to watch ITV when I was growing up. Or this will be, I wasn't allowed to watch Netflix when I was growing up. Yeah. We had to watch Apple TV Plus. Ooh, get you. It'll be like that, won't it? Possibly, if these streamers do become the brands that they hope to be. Well, we were talking there about Apple TV Plus, on which we'll play Lessons in Chemistry. It looks super interesting, that one. And that is premiering on October the 13th. Thanks very much, Scott. Holly, we're back to you. We're returning, as well we might, to the wonderful Sarah Lucas survey show. What a lovely time. I'm looking forward to getting my teeth into this. So for the uninitiated who know her as a name that was wafting around the YBAs and all the rest of it, what pigeonhole, if we must, do we put Sarah Lucas's art into?
Well, I think the YBA is the big pigeonhole, right? I think all YBA artists hate being referred to as YBA artists.
I suppose I'm giving it the sense of an era rather than a type of art.
And I use it all the time. Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, it's quite funny. I and also... young British artist maybe doesn't cut it now when everyone's a little bit older. But
late 50s but, British artist.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, Sarah Lucas was a really, really important part of the YBA movement. She famously set up the shop with Tracy Emin at the top of Brick Lane, where they worked and created art in this little six-month lease whilst living upstairs in sleeping bags, surrounded by rats, you know, all the kind of apocryphal tales in that sense. But Sarah Lucas's work is always irreverent. It's always a bit tongue-in-cheek. It's always so very cool. It tends to focus around sculpture. I think she's probably best known for sculpture, but also photography, particularly self-portraiture and portraits of herself. So in terms of sculptures themselves, everyone will probably be familiar with sort of strange body types on chairs.
Yes.
So
floppy, floppy kind of body alike things made with feminized products. And
yeah,
things,
so suppose, very, you know, a lot of tights, a lot of like horrible nude tights stuffed full of things that create body things that sometimes will look like legs or might look like body masses or might look like breasts. Also, the work that she did in Venice, she represented Britain at the Venice Biennale in, I think it was 2015, where there were body casts, so mostly legs and, you know, the bottom half of the body with cigarettes in various orifices and in a different array of poses from crossed legs to maybe something a little bit sexier. And in terms of her, you know, portraiture, self-portrait with fried eggs where she's got fried eggs on her chest or sort of eating a banana, she's pulling a fantastic face in that in that photograph. So there's you know, she's a very...
And she's super photogenic.
Yeah,
as well, and that's kind of a part of her work. It seemed to me an important part of her
work. Yeah, but I think in the sense that she is very self-assured and also is someone that I would definitely describe as like having quite a lot of swag. So she's she's commanding the lens, but she, you know, it's not sort of a, we'll, you know, get on to tropes of beauty later, but she's a, she's someone who's very much in command of her own image. So this exhibition is going to be a real treat. It's going to be a survey of her entire career, around 75 works from across four decades at Tate Britain. A mega show, which still, when you look, especially on a global scale, but even in the UK, even for London, for a living female artist to have a massive solo show like this is still pretty rare. I mean, at the moment, obviously, we've got Yayoi Kusama, which is a massive one in the other Tate. But still, it's something that doesn't happen very much. And so the chance to see all of this work together, as well as newer works where she's actually started to work in bronze as well, where she's taking some of the tropes from earlier works and recasting them in this completely different material, is also quite interesting. But she's always someone who, you know, she's pointing the finger at tropes to do with beauty and gender and race and class, but also sort of having fun with it too.
It's really interesting, her riffing on her earlier work and casting in bronze and things like that. She's always on the cusp of, she's obviously a successful artist in whatever way you choose to take that, but always kind of pushing. It always seems, if I don't know, it always seems like she's happy and slightly awkward in that commercial space perhaps as well.
Yeah, I think so. I think especially in, you know, if you think, you know, the YBAs and, you know, making Britain Cool Britannia, whatever term you want to use, you know, that was sort of the advent of the contemporary art market in many in many ways, you know, especially in Britain. And, you know, the idea of the buyability, you know, we've had this huge rise in the painting fever, right? Because it's a lot easier to buy a painting and hang it in your house or put it in storage. But, you know, it's so there's always this question of, you know, why is this art being made? Who's it for? And I think that with Sarah Lucas, you can feel that it's very much coming from a place when she's making very specifically the art that she wants. And even again, even though technically it's not, there's also this idea of ephemerality. Anyone who has put on a pair of 15 denier tights knows that they do not last long.
That beautifully sums up the impermanence and beauty of Sarah Lucas's work. And that's Tate Britain. That kicks off on the 28th of September this year. Thank you very much, Holly. Chris, back to you for the new one, upcoming one, I should say, from Teju Cole. And what is the brilliant Teju Cole? What's on his mind this time?
Well, what's on his mind?
Have I asked you a terrible question that you can't answer? Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Don't know. No, a lot is on his mind, judging by... I've only been able to skim this book so far. I'm looking forward to diving in. But it's his first novel since 2011, since the really extraordinary Open City. And since then, he's published several books, but essays, books of photography. He apparently takes 1,000 photographs a month, and he's... you know, he's sort of done these incredible projects on Instagram and Twitter and then left those platforms when he feels his sort of his work is done. So a really interesting thinker and an interesting artist. This one is about a teacher at a college that sounds a lot like Harvard, which is where Teju Cole teaches creative writing. This guy, Tunde, he teaches photography. And it loosely follows him. He goes on an antique shopping trip. He goes to Bamako in Mali. He goes to Lagos in Nigeria, where he grew up. And I think there's a lot in the mix about sort of colonialism and the legacies of colonialism, and about music and art and photography. He writes about Ingmar Bergman's Winter Light and Abbas Kiarostami and Thelonious Monk, a Turner painting called Slavers Throwing Overboard the Dead and Dying. I guess I'm looking forward to finding out how he sort of works these into a novel, or whether it feels like his sort of essay writing under a different rubric.
Yes, it's interesting stuff. I feel like he's casting his net quite wide there, and but he's got that kind of Sebaldian quality to be able to kind of do these affect these incredible changes on the page, where you feel like you can feel your brain shifting somewhere inside. You're going on this journey with him, and you know it, you have to be a supple reader perhaps to kind of go on some of those journeys with him.
I think that's a good way of putting it, because he is a very elegant writer, and it is sort of the quality of his attention that you read him for, you know, the way he sees things and the things he chooses to see. There was a line I read actually just on my way over here where Tunde sort of lets his class talk about whatever they've experienced in the last week. At the start of class, they have a sort of like free session, but he writes, "Anything may be discussed during the opening segment of class, with the sole exception of Brexit." He intends for this to be taken as a joke, but he finds that each time he says it, he means it not entirely as a joke. An anti-colonial side of him resents having to hear about British politics at all. Hadn't that been the headache of being under the British Empire, having been made to care about British customs, British history, British needs? So I love the way he kind of like makes a joke or makes you laugh or plants an aside, but then actually makes it the central point and makes a serious point from that, you know, that's sort of particularly resonant for a British reader. Because I think you definitely don't really read him for plot. He actually said in a recent interview about this book, he said, "I have a slight interest in plot." And I think that even that might be over-egging it a bit. But he does have a strong interest in structure. So I think that he acknowledged the plotlessness when the interviewer said, "Like, so what's your book about?" He said, "It's about 260 pages. And maybe that's the best way to approach it. You really want to sort of have the pleasure of thinking alongside him, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly the feeling. That is going to be called Tremor by Teju Cole. That's coming out on the 19th of October. Thanks, Chris. Scott, back to you. There's going to be a murder. There has been a murder at the end of the world.
Yes, and I'm intrigued by this one, not just because of the title. I mean, bizarre. But I think it's just that the fact that this is made by the same team who made The OA. And if you are very familiar with The OA, it's a show that will stay in your mind. It stars Britt Marling. But it's also, I think, one of the daftest shows that I've ever seen. It is quite indescribable. It's on for two series on Netflix. It sadly got cancelled. But it went so to the fringes of what is, I mean, if you wrote the synopsis down on paper, you wouldn't believe it, but also I don't think you would understand it. And I think it got a core massive fan base because it was able to be really distinctive and take a lot of bold risks. Now, I think it alienated quite a few people, and that's why Netflix didn't continue on the series after the second series had come to an end, which ended on one of the most WTF finales and cliffhangers I've ever seen of any TV show. There's been a lot of expectation that they were going to be carrying on this show somewhere else, but so far that hasn't come to fruition. But this new show that is done by the same people behind it stars Emma Corrin as an amateur detective, and they are invited to a reclusive billionaire's retreat on a remote location. And then, of course, one of the guests is found dead. Now, that sort of sounds very familiar to the latest Knives Out film. And also, I think that that sort of synopsis has been adapted or taken in many different directions by other people. But I think what stands out for this is that I see the synopsis and I go, that can't be the plot, because the plot of this,
you feel the makers of it have something else, many things
very
up their
much
sleeve.
In mind. They'll drag you in with this, so then they'll spit you out in a completely different direction.
Nice. So that is The Murder at the End of the World. That is FX on Hulu. That's premiering on November the 14th. Thank you very much, Scott. Holly, back to you. For The Cult of Beauty at the Wellcome Collection, spitting distance or a stone's throw, whichever propulsive or disgusting measure of distance you prefer. We're back into quite political shows, it sounds, at the Wellcome Collection. Of late, there have been a few, haven't we? We've just come off the back of Milk. Where are we going with The Cult of Beauty?
Yes, well, I think it's really great that you just noted Milk, because I think that was a really interesting show. The Wellcome Collection do seem really good. They're doing a lot, let's say.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
You're covering scientific discovery, socio-political histories and context, photography, archives, often like new artistic commissions as well. So The Cult of Beauty is sort of trying to give an overview of the phenomenon that is beauty, what the perception
of beauty. And quite fighting talk in the title, the fact that it's a cult, not a fact.
The cult, yeah, beauty, yeah. With over 200 pieces. So I think it's fair to say that there's definitely a skew to do with beauty in the sense of what it means to be a woman within the frame of beauty. I think from everything that I've seen and heard, that is the framework for it. And it's looking at both, you know, the idea of ideals of beauty, whether they be historical or contemporary, but also the beauty industry, which is obviously a huge slice of the pie, as it were. You know,
so much of the imagery comes from is sides of buses, magazine adverts,
exactly.
Et
yeah. And you know, looking at something from, you know, one of the earliest sort of celebrity makeup brands, which actually Josephine Baker, who had her own brand of tanning oil and pomade, up to Fenty Beauty, which is one of the biggest brands that are out there now.
This is Rihanna's.
That's Rihanna's brand, yes. And I think that something that's always really interesting is that you get sort of snapshots with the Wellcome, because it's not a huge space, and they are often they've obviously got loans, but they're looking at their own collection. This show is going to have an awful lot going on. So it will have everything from sort of an ancient Egyptian mirror to an 18th century corset to photography from contemporary artists like Juno Calypso, who her work deals a lot with the ideals of beauty, but in a very uncanny, slightly freaky way of, you know, sort of strange, beautiful women in weird salmon-coloured living rooms, like wearing a strange LED face mask, which are very big in Korea, and things like this. But then, you know, also looking at the intersection of, you know, race and class and wealth. So they're going to have beautiful photos by Raphael Albert, who was known for his photos of the Miss Black and Beautiful pageant that happened in London in the 1970s. So there's going to be a huge array of work. There's also going to be some really interesting new commissions, which I think the Wellcome Collection stick their neck out quite a lot. That sometimes you'll go and see a show, I felt a bit like this with Milk, and you go into the last sort of gallery space and you're just like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah. Like, come on, guys.
Again, yeah. The immersive word comes out, but they're going to have a new
sculpture. The I word.
They're going to have a new sculpture by an artist called Narcissista, who is a Brooklyn-based performance artist who does a lot with sort of mannequin faces and perceptions of beauty. And also Beauty Sensorium, which looks at the iconography of beauty in the Renaissance, which is sort of done in a collaboration with a couple of different people, but one of them is Professor Jill Burke, who also wrote a book that's sort of coming out with the exhibition, which is called How to Be a Renaissance Woman, which covers not only the history of beauty in basically Renaissance Italy, but particularly Venice, but also has loads of recipes that you can try without all the poisonous bits in it.
It sounds great. Beautifully described. The Cult of Beauty at the Wellcome Collection. That kicks off on the 26th of October. Chris, we're coming back to you finally. With a screech of brakes, I think. But I'm poor timing control on this programme, so I'm sorry. This is no small subject, I suppose. This is Juliet, new from Sondra Newman, the daring reimagining of 1984, no less. So who is Julia and where are we in this world?
Well, Julia is Julia Worthing, who is Winston Smith, main character in 1984, is his lover and his fellow prisoner in the dungeons of the Ministry of Love when it all goes pear-shaped for the pair of them.
I like your synopsis. Put that on the back.
I think
that
is
on the back.
I think that
classics.
Is on the back of the Penguin Classics edition.
Yeah, Penguin Classics.
And this is it's a really ingenious reworking. I mean, she's basically sort of, it's a kind of double helix, I suppose, because you've got the Julia and Winston Smith scenes, which are exactly the same, partly thanks to George Orwell now being out of copyright.
Yes.
He died 75 years ago.
Andy.
But you've got these scenes which are, you know, word for word the same as they appear in Orwell's original book. But then you follow not Winston Smith, but Julia, and you find out how she sources all the black market goods that she brings to Winston in Orwell's book, but which Winston seems to be completely uninterested in, how she's actually finding them. You find out a bit more about her working life, which sort of ties into sort of concerns about or interests in large language learning models and AI writing fiction. You know, she works in the fiction department where these machines churn out books. Mm. And she used to work in Pornosec, which is in Orwell's book. Mm. And he mentions like these filthy novels called like Spanking Stories, for example. But Sandra Newman adds one called Comrade, My Telly Screen Is Broken, which I think is just brilliant. And she brings this sort of sly humour, which you can say a lot of things about 1984, but you can't say it's a very funny book. But she does bring this sense of humour in these moments where Winston Smith is kind of like, they've had sex and he's kind of lying back and thinking it's just been this wonderful experience. And Julia, who hasn't had an orgasm, is just kind of lying there going, well, is that it? And so it's a really interesting.
So the ministries of love and truth intersect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, nasty surprises in both, yeah, or in all.
Exactly. So pretty daring stuff. Just as a last note on Julia by Sandra Newman, what world have we been in with Sandra Newman's other novels?
Yeah, so she's running a line in sort of dystopian fiction, I guess, in The Heavens and the Men, which I must admit neither of which I've read, but she is sort of
high concept,
I guess,
stuff.
An ideal candidate to kind of, you know, turn her mind to one of the most famous dystopias of all.
Perfect. Well, that was Julia by Sandra Newman. That's published by Granta on October the 19th. Thanks, Chris, for whipping through that one. So to recap, keep your eyes and ears peeled for the TV shows Lessons in Chemistry, A Murder at the End of the World, and Good Old Frasier. The exhibitions Sarah Lucas, Happy Gas, The Cult of Beauty, and Inside Other Spaces, Environments by Women Artists. That's at Munich's Haus der Kunst. And the books we talked about, The Walls of Eternity by Karl-Ove Knausgård, Tremor by Teju Cole, and Julia There by Sandra Newman. That is it for this week. My thanks to Scott Bryan, Holly Black, and Chris Power. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Mollahan-Coombs and Steph Chungu, and Steph also edits the show. Thanks also this week to our researcher, Caitlin Danaher. We'll be back at the same time next week, but until then, from me, Robert Bounds, thank you very much for tuning in.